from a relatively recent court case with respect to decisions on catch limits for fisheries stocks and quota management system. This is a bill from Jim Anderton, and I understand it has broad support within the House. There are two aquaculture bills which are due for introduction. One I've probably mentioned here in the last couple of weeks addresses issues arising out of an environment court case some time ago involving Tasman District. And the second bill addresses a range of issues to ensure proper consideration of applications for aquaculture initiatives. You'll be aware that aquaculture management areas haven't exactly been forthcoming under the new legislation, so there's been a lot of work done on how the legislation might be more facilitative of consideration of initiatives than it has been. And both those bills are in the name of Trevor Mallard as Minister for the Environment. We've also approved the content of the amending legislation which Trevor Mallard foreshadowed 2 Sundays ago on KiwiSaver. And also ready for introduction is the Private Security Personnel and Private Investigators Bill. That's one in the name of Clayton Cosgrove as Associate Minister of Justice. A discussion document approved for release in the Andalzeals area is on the New Zealand Food Supplement Food Standard. And there's also ready for release the Skills Strategy Action Plan, which is a tripartite initiative involving government, industry training federation, Business New Zealand and Council of Trade Unions, and I will be releasing that when I address the Industry Training Federation annual conference tomorrow morning. Coming up in the House this week, we're expecting to have a couple of third readings and a number of first readings of bills. We hope to take the China Free Trade Agreement Bill through to its third reading, and also the Births, Deaths, Marriages and Relationships Registration Amendment Bill. Third reading should continue this week. We have first readings to complete on the Public Lending Right Bill for New Zealand authors, on taxation, International Tax, Life Insurance and Remedial Provisions Bill, to be done a bill, on judicial matters, Dr. Cullen Bill, and on disability, United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, or Dyson Bill, which would enable us, once passed, to ratify the relatively new UN Convention on Disabilities, which New Zealand played a considerable part in brokering under the supervision of Don Mackay, who was our ambassador in New York and to the UN at the time. Coming up this week, it's Māori Language Week, so there's a number of initiatives around that. It's also a Rail Safety Week. There's a focus on rail safety ads on screen this week. Rick Barker's statement out published today reminds us all that Class A drugs cases, like those involving methamphetamine, will now be heard in the district court, and that's expected to speed up procedures. Chris Carter this week will be releasing latest information on statistics around school leavers for 2007 and figures on student suspensions, exclusions, stand downs and so on. There's some quite positive results there. I released last weekend results for the Pacifica students, which show that in the schools where there have been specific initiatives against suspensions, so the Pacific students' suspension rate is down around 29%, and across New Zealand down about 17%, which is obviously very consistent with our objective of having teenagers stay in school longer and hopefully achieve more as well. Otherwise, coming up this week, Trevor Mallard will be releasing the draft national policy statement on fresh water. That will go to a board of inquiry, which examines it, hears from stakeholders in the public. That's quite a lengthy process. Ruth Dyson this week will be releasing information about the first providers who will be receiving extra support under the policy I announced in my PM statement in February, where we're moving over several years to full cost funding for essential social services contracted to the government. Obviously, there's a statement from the Reserve Bank expected to come Thursday. Also Thursday, there'll be an initiative around funding for new school-based youth health initiatives. Statements around recycling initiatives in public places rolling out elsewhere in New Zealand from Kevin Mallard. And come Saturday, of course, we have the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, having a formal visit here, bilateral talks with Winston Peters, talks with me. I'll be hosting a minister dinner for her. And then she moves on to Samoa for the meeting with Pacific foreign ministers. And undoubtedly, Fiji will be one of the issues she is interested on. I've noted with considerable concern the statement from Fiji's interim Prime Minister, Commodore Bainimarama, which says, in effect, that Fiji never expected to hold elections before 2010. That, of course, is directly contrary to assurances which he gave foreign leaders, of whom I was one, sitting in a retreat at the Pacific Island Forum in Vavau, Tonga last year. At that time, he assured leaders that there would be elections held by the end of March 2009. He further gave the assurance that there would be elections conducted within Fiji's current constitution and electoral law. Both those commitments, of course, have now been shattered, and I think that's a matter of considerable concern for the Pacific Island Forum, and something that will undoubtedly not only feature at the meeting in Samoa at the weekend, but also very much at the Pacific Island Forum leaders' meeting in Niue in the third week in August. Any questions?
Well, do you think that Winston Peters could be in trouble in terms of his obligation to declare gifts or donations under pecuniary interest legislation?
I think that would very much depend on whether it was deemed to be a pecuniary interest. As you know, the legislation was passed for members of Parliament to declare pecuniary interests. That actually took over the previous ministerial declaration of interest. So now ministers and all members of Parliament declare under the same provisions, this time of statute. The register can make a decision to make further inquiries about declarations. If the registrar determines that they may not be complete, the matter can be referred to the Auditor General. It can be a matter taken up by the Auditor General of his own volition. I note that Mr. Hyde is talking about referring the matter as a privileges matter, and that, of course, is something on which only the Speaker can rule whether it's a prima facie case.
Do you think it's credible for Mr. Peters to say that he didn't, he says he didn't know about the donation? Do you believe that he didn't go back when these issues were brought to the public attention by the Herald and go and check who the donations had come from to this Biden fund?
Well, I'm in the position that Mr. Peters is an honourable member, and I must accept his word unless I have evidence to the contrary. I also note that his lawyer entirely backs up what Mr. Peters has said, and his lawyer has, of course, professional obligations to the Law Society.
Do you accept that Mr. Peters' argument that he did not benefit from the donation?
Well, that's at the heart of what I said in response to the first question. This very much depends on whether this is deemed to be a pecuniary interest, and that's not something I can rule on. That's something that is determined by others.
Isn't it so serious, though, Mr. Peters may be confused about it, that it is worthy of giving the Auditor General in?
As I said, the Registrar of Pecuniary Interests can refer the matter to the Auditor General. The Auditor General may, of his own volition, investigate the matter.
As Prime Minister, do you have any concerns about his position in your executive as a minister, given these events?
I've said in the past week on that particular subject that Mr. Peters has performed with integrity as Foreign Minister. And that these are matters that relate not to ministerial performance, but they relate to whether or not there's a pecuniary interest, and that is not something that I can judge. There are proper procedures for that under the legislation.
Are you aware of either Margaret Baisley or Kevin Brady taking an interest in this?
I don't have any knowledge of that at this point, but I guess, like you, they'll be following the debate around it.
How would you feel about, you know, a large anonymous donor paying a private bill of any of your own Labor ministers and cabinet? Would you expect them to declare it to you?
Firstly, I don't believe any of our Labor ministers have been in that position. The last time one of our members faced substantial private litigation was Mr. Mallard with respect to Mr. Morgan, and at that time the Labor Party caucus helped Mr. Mallard, so that was before we went into government. So of course when you're in government, the things that people tend to litigate against you about are matters which affect you in your ministerial capacity. And if that's the case, then the matter goes to the Attorney General for consideration as to whether he will ask the Cabinet to pick up expenses. So I just can't think of any precedent for this at all.
How could someone pay the debt for Mr. Peters, a debt that he would otherwise presumably have to have picked up, not be a pecuniary interest?
Well, I think that's really something that the Registrar would need to consider. Or ask the Attorney General to consider if they feel that is warranted.
The lawyer said this morning that he would present the legal bill to Mr. Peters, the total bill with the amount taken off it that had been paid for. So doesn't that, say that he was aware, you know, that people were, or that someone was giving him money at that stage in terms of what he knew and what he didn't?
Well, obviously he would have been aware that what he paid was substantially less than the total cost, but it's jumping from A to Z to say that he would then necessarily have been aware of who the actual donors were to that particular sum. And I note in Mr. Henry's comments to Radio New Zealand this morning, he makes the point that support for the legal case came in for this one in very much the same way as it did when he conducted the case, I believe, or was involved in the case on behalf of Mr. Creech in Wairarapa for the National Party. So the lawyer didn't seem to see any particular distinction between this one and another petition he'd been involved in.
Given the need for MPs to disclose these sorts of things, wouldn't it be incumbent at him at that point to make further inquiries about where it had come from, given there is an obligation to disclose?
Well, it all comes back to whether this is considered a pecuniary interest, and that's not something I can rule on. There is a proper process under statute.
Could it have been pretty easy to have dealt with if you look at what Nick Smith has done? I think he's just set up a freedom of speech trust where he says he's got some interest. It doesn't tell us who's getting money or how much he's received.
That's the point. We don't have a clue who has given money to Mr. Smith either. But what we do know from Mr. Henry's interview this morning is that Mr. Henry considers that the money for this particular case was gathered in the same way as it was gathered for Mr. Creech's petition back when the Wairarapa electorate case was contested after the 1987.
Are you satisfied that Mr. Peters has upheld the highest ethical standards as required by the Cabinet Men?
Well, I don't have evidence to the contrary. As I say, I've accepted his word as an honourable member, and I've noted the word of his lawyer as a man with obligations to his profession.
Was any Labour MP or official involved in talking to Mr. Glenn last week?
Well, not to the best of my knowledge. I would say, though, as Mr. Williams said in his statement to media yesterday, that his job is to maintain relations with donors. So from time to time, he will undoubtedly speak with donors like Mr. Glenn. But from my point of view, it's very important for me not to be involved in funding relationships which the Labor Party has, and those are matters for Mr. Williams.
But when you saw the discrepancy last week between the email and what Mr. Peters was saying, did you ever consider getting somebody like Mr. Williams to pick up the phone and just ask Mr. Glenn if he thought he'd given to New Zealand First?
Well, Mr. Peters, of course, spoke to me the weekend that the Herald published the email, and he said then what he'd said publicly, which was that he had not received money personally, and nor had New Zealand First. Now, from his statement on Friday night, it's clear that a third avenue opened up, and that third avenue was that there was a donation to the costs of a legal case. And what this whole discussion now hangs around is whether or not that was a pecuniary interest, and whether Mr. Peters should have disclosed the fact that some unknown person or persons had contributed to that case.
And Labor had debts over the federal election campaign. Mr. Glenn came forward and assisted anonymously with $100,000 interest-free loan.
Oh, well, that was actually declared, you recall. It was declared in our accounts. Mr. Glenn's funding has been transparent to the New Zealand Labor Party.
Do you agree with Mr. Peters that the New Zealand Herald is white and Mr. Labor?
Well, clearly the New Zealand Herald was right that money had gone from Mr. Glenn to what Mr. Glenn believed was Mr. Peters. But we have here three possible avenues for donations. One is to the party, which Mr. Peters ruled out. The second was to him personally, which he ruled out. And the third, which is now obvious, is to legal costs, legal fighting fund, legal defence, however one terms it.
Are you concerned that it may look to the public as if Mr. Glenn was essentially trying to buy the honorary consul job in Monaco from your foreign minister?
Well, if we take Mr. Peters at his word, as I must as an honourable member, and I take his lawyer at his word, Mr. Peters would not have been in the loop on the source of the funding.
Are you looking back at that at all to maybe ask for any communication, to see any communication between Mr. Peters and Mr. Glenn?
No, because I consider it very unlikely that any appointment will be made to the Monaco post. There is no post.
So you're not going to set up a post?
Well, I've taken people at their word.
No, you're not going to have an honorary position?
No. And this has come up over the years, but there's never been any appointment. You'll recall that Mr. Worth lobbied rather hard for a friend of his to be appointed the Honorary Consul.
It's never been raised with you by Mr. Peters?
Mr. Peters certainly at some point has raised it. But as I say, if Mr. Peters was not in a loop about who was funding legal costs, then the issue of a conflict doesn't arise.
Do you think Mr. Glenn's motivation, though, could have been that he wanted the job and that that's why he gave the money?
I very much doubt it. I've met honorary consuls all around the world. They are, for the most part, well-heeled people, often expatriates, sometimes not. If not, they may have a particular lifelong interest in New Zealand or business interests in New Zealand. And as I've said before, these people generally put quite a lot of their own money into representing New Zealand because they either have a love and affection for it or because they have business interests in New Zealand, whatever.
So just to clarify, Mr. Peters did raise it specifically about Owen Glenn showing interest in the honorary consul when
you
raised it with you?
Oh, look, this was all fully discussed when the matter came to the public arena last February. And I would have been aware before that, yes, that he was considering it. Because I do see most foreign affairs briefing papers and material.
Have you asked Mr. Peters directly if Owen Glenn's ever talked to him about wanting to donate to Mr. Peters or the party?
No, I haven't asked that question. What I've asked is, with respect to the various media reports, and these go back to February, had a donation been received by him or the party? And I've always had the same answer as you have had. And the answer was no. In the case of the media, it was to hold it aside.
Going back to your comments on Fiji, is there anything more that you could see that the government, your government, could do to push Fiji in the right direction in terms of tighter standards?
I think the key thing now is for the New Zealand government to be working with other Pacific governments on the next steps, because having Pacific Island forum unity around this is very, very important. It has to be borne in mind that by and large the Commonwealth and the United Nations have referred to the Pacific Islands forum to be dealing with this issue. We are obviously liaising with other forum governments in the run-up to the Pacific Island Forum. There will be a report compiled by the forum delegation that Mr. Peters was part of last week to go to the leaders, and it will all be discussed in the room.
Sorry, in Fiji last week, Winston Peters has said that it was obvious the sanctions were hurting Fiji, but it wasn't clear whether they were having the desired effect of actually pushing Fiji towards democracy. Do you think that the jury's out on the sanctions as to their effectiveness?
Well, I think they have been effective, because those who are used to rather freely entering New Zealand on visas have found their freedom of travel severely circumscribed. So that, on the other hand, hasn't led the Commodore to see elections and a graceful exit as a way out of his predicament. He keeps protracting the rule that he established at the barrel of the gun.
What options does
his claim, Prime Minister, that changing the race-based electoral system would actually break the coup culture in Fiji?
Well, would it? You see, you could argue that if you went to a simple system where everybody was enrolled in the same roles, you might end up underrepresenting the Indian minority interests and other interests. My recollection is that the constitution which Fiji has was very carefully worked through. The Commonwealth was involved. I think Alison Quinton Baxter, who's very well respected as a Pacific constitutional advisor, was consulted. There was a full process that put the current constitution in place. If there's a coup culture, no constitution's going to stop it. It has to be in the hearts of people not to support biffing governments they don't like through military intervention.
So do you think the Commonwealth under Sir Paul Reeves' assistance will make any progress?
Well, that's hard to say, because Sir Paul hasn't had an easy time seeing who he's wanted to see, when he's wanted to see them, on the visits that he's made.
What options does the forum have? Does it have a facility like the Commonwealth to suspend membership? Has it ever happened?
It certainly has its expectations of membership, and those were set out pretty clearly in that Bikitawa Declaration at the very first forum meeting that I ever went to, which was in Kiribati in the year 2000, and that was designed to try and find a way back for troubled members. But of course it's very difficult to help people who don't want to be helped. The forum has stood ready to support Fiji with a move back to democracy, so is the European Union, the Commonwealth, the UN. But Fiji's interim government to this point hasn't wanted to walk down that road in any realistic time frame.
Would you envisage possibly you going to Niue and suggesting that they should be cut out of the forum?
Well, I haven't researched precisely whether there is a suspension mechanism with the Commonwealth. There are quite elaborate procedures, yeah, as you know, where a country may go and watch a Commonwealth Ministerial Action Group. It may be suspended altogether, as happened with Zimbabwe and has happened with Pakistan and others in the past, but I haven't precisely researched exactly what the position of the forum would be.
Would there be a mood for that sort of action? in your reading at the moment?
Well, I think the mood in the forum would be to try to continue in a dialogue with Fiji as a member in trouble. That's been the way in the past when Fiji's been in trouble. It's been the way when the Solomon Islands has been in trouble. It's, I guess, been the way when Tom has been in trouble, to try and work to support finding a way through. But I repeat, it's very hard to help people who don't particularly want to be helped.
Commodore Bainimarama's reaction, especially over the last couple of days about the elections, doesn't it show that he's really not particularly interested in dialogue and has really been stringing the forum along from promise to promise or commitment to commitment?
Well, unfortunately, his broken promises have caught up with him. I must say I wasn't terribly convinced by the assurances he gave the forum leaders, but they were uttered in front of me and I wrote everything down, duly reported it fully to our officials. Now, I find that he said things, which he now clearly had no intention of ever honouring. He now says that he would intend to have elections in 2009. That is not what he said to my face.
How much do you think it's about keeping his own position as opposed to any political?
Well, I wonder to what extent it's about an exit strategy, because as it stands, of course, he would be guilty of rather serious crimes such as treason.
What about a vote to the presidency?
Well, of course, there's someone in that position at the moment. Perhaps that's the next stage of the coup.
Prime Minister, at this stage, do you have any idea where the $750 million might come from for the universal student allowance if you choose to go ahead with it?
Well, I don't have any figure like that. I would think that figure is substantially on the high side. It's got to be remembered that if you were to go to universal student allowance now, 57%. Of students are already qualifying for student allowance. So I've often said on the record that if I had a dream, it would be to return to the universal allowance. That's certainly something I enjoyed as a student and my generation did. But it's not been possible for us in the past to go to that extent. And we've done a lot of other things to support students. We've kept the fees capped, which has been helpful, and of course the no interest policy has been extremely important and has been widening the eligibility for the allowance.
Prime Minister, the Bali bombers, it seems they've exhausted most of their legal avenues now and could face execution. Do you think that's the appropriate punishment for them?
The New Zealand government does not support the death penalty under any circumstances. Clearly these men are guilty of heinous crimes, and those crimes in any jurisdiction would justify them very serious penalties available under law. But the New Zealand government will not and does not support the death penalty.
And the weekly question about the emissions trading scheme, is the negotiation still ongoing?
Ongoing. I'm sure the questions will be taken.